Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today I want to talk about American trade unions and American labour in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War, and how the Second World War had really changed the experience of organised labour in the United States. The Second World War had, of course, dramatically expanded the size of America's labour pool and workforce. There were large numbers of people, not just women, but men as well, who entered the manufacturing and primary industries for the first time. And there had obviously been a huge, what would, you know, Marxists would call a reserve army of labour, of the unemployed, beforehand, and during the Great Depression. Not only had war work for many people restored self-esteem, providing them with well-paid labour for the first time in several years, but it also was war work with a political, ideological and moral subtext. It had been war work that had defeated Nazism, Italian fascism and, of course, Japanese imperialism. One of the interesting economic effects of the war, and one which could actually be quite destabilising in the long run in terms of labour relations, prices, inflation and employment, was the development in America between 1941 and 1945 of almost uniform full employment. A society that doesn't have any kind of any pool of unemployed or any significant pool of unemployed can face all sorts of economic phenomena. For example, these are societies which are prone to inflation unless price controls and rationing are strictly observed. Obviously, price controls and rationing in America during the war are strictly observed, but for different reasons. And it just so happens to have a counter-inflationary effect. But the other phenomena is that when there is almost full employment, unions are normally at their most powerful. The reserve pool of the unemployed, who can always be used by employers to bring down aggregate labour costs, who can be used as a kind of potential competitor with employed workers to moderate pay claims. That pool of unemployed doesn't exist, and this plays into the union's hands very successfully, i.e. if there's great demand for workers, then there are actually workers, then unsatisfied employees can simply go to another job as quickly as possible. Instead of workers being played off against one another, all of a sudden it's employers. So this condition made the unions much more powerful than they had been. Unionism had dramatically developed during the New Deal. The CIO, for example, the of industrial organisations, was founded midway in the New Deal in 1936. And as with its counterparts in Great Britain, The CIO was an unskilled and semi-skilled workers union, or it recruited large numbers of unskilled and semi-skilled workers, and as a result was inclined to militancy. If you look at the development of the mass unions, the new union movement in Britain before the First World War, you get a tendency towards more militant movements because these were the ones which had generally lower skilled and poorer workers and larger numbers of them who were tired of waiting patiently for the rights that their kind of artisan skilled brethren were already getting. And the union membership had gone up between 1930, where it was 3.4 million members, to 8.7 million in 1940. And this was an increase between 11.6% of industrial employment to 26.9%. During the war, this growth increases yet further. By 1945, in the union movement overall, there are 14.8 million unionised members, and which is 35.5% of manufacturing employment, and 21.9% of employment overall. So one in every five employees in the USA was a member of a trade union at the end of the Second World War. As would the experience of Britain and the British trade union movement be in the post-war era, especially from the 50s and 60s onwards, during the era of mass immigration from the Caribbean and Southeast Asia and the Indian subcontinent, the trade union movement in America would be no guarantor of liberal attitudes towards race and also towards gender. The union movement in America in the post-war era was highly class-conscious. There was a strong working-class identity, but it was, for the most part, in the unions, a white working-class identity. The New Deal had done much for the white working class in terms of its sense of its rights, entitlements and identity, but there was very little cross interracial solidarity that was shown. Membership of the CIO for black workers and for and admitting women workers was particularly poor. But in a way, this is a reflection of racial conflict as has always existed within American life, that different economic groups, different ethnic groups have been encouraged since the birth of the Republic, really, and particularly after the emancipation of the slaves, to see themselves as antagonistic to one another, and this has helped American capital immensely to drive down labour costs. That said, in 1945, a powerful American trade union movement was able to pull American politics towards the social democratic left and to ensure that the achievements of the New Deal were not overturned. And it would take really until the 1970s and even arguably the 1980s to make the first serious inroads into the New Deal. Under the presidencies of Nixon and later Reagan, both of whom were not embarrassed about openly declaring their own private war on the trade union movement. A case in point, of course, being the air traffic controllers dispute and Reagan's deliberate provocations of unionised air traffic control during the 1980s. The unions were really the most significant left-wing show in town by 1945. The Communist Party of the USA and the left end of the Democrat Party were far less significant in terms of securing rights for the working class. other organisations, civil rights organisations, which were generally on the liberal and left end of the political spectrum, had only influence in very narrow policy areas. But as we'll see, the period after 1945, the kind of decade after 1945, and arguably long into the post-war era, was going to be a bleak time for the left in general. A organised and highly motivated war on democratic socialism was going to be waged under the Eisenhower and Truman administrations. Now, interestingly, in one of the previous podcasts, a very recent one, I've talked about Eisenhower and the CIA during the 1950s, particularly following the death of Stalin, and how the desire to wage the Cold War had a significant impact on everyday American life, really altering the foundations of the Republic away from its arguably its founding doctrines towards being a more militarized, less democratic, more statist, more centralized state geared up to waging endless struggle against the Soviet Union. In this environment, it was unlikely that even large labor unions would come off unscathed, and certainly small democratic parties or radical left-wing parties were going to have a very difficult time indeed. The union movement itself was poised to be hit with a wave of reaction after the Second World War, really pent up by business elites and America's wealthy from the New Deal era onwards. There's very little that could be done to organise labour during the Second World War. When the conflict was over, there could be significant inroads made into the gains that Labour and the left had made during the 1930s and 40s. However, to look at the union movement and view it as being particularly socialist is to misunderstand it, rather. Certainly it was there to advance the interests of its members, but many of the leading trade unionists from the 30s onwards, during that decade of intense ideological struggle, had shorn themselves of any notions of democratic or revolutionary Marxism, and really thought that they had just a kind of a functional job, not to change society, but to manage it with capitalism still as the predominant economic system, in the interests of a broader demographic. The belief that socialism would not and could not implant itself in the USA was particularly acute in 1945, and the American trade unionist Walter Reuther from the United Automobile Workers, who has had a sojourn in the USSR during the 1930s. You can read a lot about him in Tim Zouliadis' brilliant book, Forsaken, which is the story of the forgotten American victims of Stalin's gulags. Many of them were auto workers from Ford, lured to the Soviet Union in the middle of the Great Depression on the understanding that there would be jobs and aplenty, only to be swept up in the Stalinist paranoia of the later 1930s. Well, Reuther returned and really, by 1945, shorn himself of socialist ideas.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
And thought that Labour would take the lead in creating a more progressive society, a society where workers, black and white, were treated equally, and when the condition of the poor were to be raised. But he didn't believe that Marxist ideas had any part to play in this. Instead, Reuther really imagined that the union movement could bring about a kind of self-reforming capitalism. And he looked for an enhanced New Deal, the sorts of things that Roosevelt was perhaps always hoping to do had he not been interrupted by war and later ill health, a welfare state, a minimum wage or a guaranteed annual wage, as it was referred to at the time, civil rights for all minorities, and federal legislation to ensure education, national federal education services, and a national health service. I don't really want to use the British term there, but a what you would describe now as a single payer healthcare system. Reuther also wanted to see a corporatism introduced, a kind of a democratic corporatism, where management, workers, and government helped to coordinate industry and bring about technical and scientific development. And this was, corporatism is obviously nothing new. It had been tried by democratic and fascist countries in the 1930s, and it had, in Reuther's eyes, something to recommend it. There were other trade unionists who demanded better treatment for their workers, but who didn't, like Reuther, have the same scope of vision, who didn't have the same broadly political outlook and the same degree of ideas about solidarity to bring about transformation for the entire working class. And so there were militant groups that had wildcat strikes throughout the war years, and slightly beforehand. In 1944, there were 4,956 workplace stoppages involving 2.12 million workers. And this was nearly 5% of all workers who were employed. Roosevelt himself was deeply alarmed by the amount of wartime stoppages. As we've said before, Roosevelt did everything he could to avoid black workers from downing tools due to their own bad treatment during the war. It was going to be extremely problematic for a war against a racist, fascist power like Nazi Germany for black workers to claim racial discrimination too. And also, a million black workers walking off the job was going to have significant damage to the US war industry. The opportunity to reduce the power of the unions was there in 1945. As we've already discussed on this podcast many times, that by 1945 there was acute anxiety that America would be tipped back into economic depression. The big spender in America, the American economy, was the state. The American economy was plunged into potential crisis. If the war industries were shut down because the war had been won, and America also started to drift back towards isolationism, then the there would be mass layoffs. Already by August 1945, workers' overtime had begun to dwindle, and the aircraft factories all over California particularly begin to shut down. If you read Anthony Sampson's The Arms Bazaar, what you see in 1945-46 isn't just a decline in the aircraft industry in California, but it's almost a collapse, and it takes government intervention, government finding reasons to continue ordering aircraft in order for this industry not to be swept away in its entirety. By the end of 1945, in some industries, workers' pay had declined by a third. There was all sorts of suspicion that shareholder prices were being propped up at the expense of workers, and wage repression was buying Wall Street an endless summer. How realistic this is unclear, but it is not unheard of for these kinds of practices to be commonplace. For example, in 1943, Charles Wilson, who was head of General Motors, had received an annual salary of $459,014. And if you imagine this, in 1945, one-fifth of working families in America received less than $1,500 in cash income per year. And the average full-time employee's wage was $2,190. It gives you a clue about the workplace disparities. I can't do the math, but if anyone wants to email me with what $459,000 is in today's money, I'll be very interested to hear. These uncertainties and anxieties led to a wave of disputes and walkouts at the end of, towards the end of 1945. In Joseph Gordon's book, Best Years, he says, at the stock exchange, the tickers fell silent when 400 clerical employees walked out. Barbers, butchers, bakers struck. Stock pages interrupted the production of copper wire. Campbell's soup, castor oil, Christmas toys. The Pittsburgh Pirates baseball team, near the cellar in the National League, took a strike vote in midsummer but decided to continue playing. So it shows you that this wave of militancy rippled through American life, and it was unsurprising that this happened, as the great economic dynamo of American life that dragged America out of the Great Depression and made America once again the wealthiest and most powerful country in the world had been the government, had been government spending and the government order book that was necessary for the war. Once this falls into crisis, there's jeopardy here as to workers' continued futures, not just in war industries, but in every other industry that was booming as a result of war spending, or really this massive Keynesian influx of cash into the economy. All these industries were starting to face paralysis. It's hardly any wonder that there was a wave of worker militancy. Workers hadn't been laid off in significant numbers at this point, and had they been, had the country been returned to the conditions of the Great Depression, organised labour might have been significantly weaker. But at this point it wasn't. There is high and anxious employment. And also, workers in jobs who are gradually getting poorer as time goes by. In Pittsburgh, for example, 3,500 electric company workers went on strike. The city's trolleys stopped. Streetlights went out, office buildings had to shut down, and 100,000 workers had to go home, and there was very little that anyone could do about it. Same sorts of thing happened in New York, in Manhattan. Strikes by elevator operators, truck drivers, dock workers, these stopped transport in and out of the city. In total, there were 4,750 strikes in 1945. And this was just 200 less than there had been the previous year. Harry Truman said, "People are somewhat befuddled and want to take time out to get a nerve rest." This is in a letter to his mother. "Some want a guarantee of rest at government expense, and some, I'm sorry to say, just want to raise hell and hamper the return to peacetime production to obtain some political advantage." This, I don't think, was either fair or realistic. There were strikes throughout 1946. 1.8 million workers in key industries such as meatpacking, the oil industry, manufacturing, steel and cars, auto manufacture went on strike. And in 1946, this becomes the key battleground in modern US US labor relation history. There were 4,000. And nearly 5,000 stoppages that year. 4.6 million workers went on strike. 1 in 14 American workers, that is. And this was the number of work days lost, actually, was 116 million, which was three times higher than in 1945. In 1946, these strikes were called out not by union leaders who were calling out wildcat strikes, but after long negotiations with management. And the negotiations were about this key issue of wage stagnation that was occurring after the war. Union leaders said that wartime and post-war inflation were eroding workers' gains. There were demands for increases in wages of up to 30%. This was the demand of the General Motors workers in Detroit. Eventually, they got a 10% raise, and this was met with strike action in December 1945. And in January that year, there were walkouts across the auto industry. And whilst these pay claims were bitterly disputed by auto workers actually were better paid than a lot of the American working class at that time. Farming, forestry and fishery workers took in something like about $1,200 a year, which is just over a third of what an auto worker would make. And to give you an interesting snapshot of the importance of production line work, of traditional blue-collar manufacturing labour, working-class labour, school teachers earned probably about $1,000 a year less. These are public school teachers, than auto workers. In 1945, the position of the automobile worker was far superior than it would be, say, 30, 40, even 50 years later, after the American auto industry was plunged into deep crisis at the end of the 60s and during the 1970s. I'm going to continue looking at labour relations in post-war America fairly shortly. We've kind of slightly run out of time on this podcast, but we will look at how government intervention really led to a huge reduction in union power and how this all tied in with the wave of anti-communist and anti-socialist paranoia and culture that existed in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War and the early years of the Cold War. Anyway, thanks for listening, and if you can give us a thumbs up on the Facebook page, come visit us, have a chat, talk about what you've heard, what you like. And also, if you can give us a good review on iTunes, that would be gratefully received. Thanks very much for listening, and I'll catch you again soon. All the best, bye-bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.